Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, sporadic disturbances outside polling booth in Ghana in what was otherwise a peaceful poll.
They are just inside and protecting the ballot boxes. They should come here to the crowd and control the crowd.
And as the ZANU-PF conference in Zimbabwe moves up gear, we hear from this analyst who bemoans the party's resistance to change.
I think it is in the DNA of Mugabe that he should not be contested. Mugabe thinks that he's a monarch.
These stories and more in this edition of Africa Link, straight from the studios of Deutsche Welle here in Bonn, Germany. Stay with us.
Top story.
People have been voting in presidential elections in Ghana on Friday, December the 7th. There was much anticipation in the country even before polling stations opened. Many people had been wondering whether election materials like ballot boxes would arrive at the 26,000 stations across the country in time. In addition, for the first time, electronic verification machines were used to identify all voters, and many people were worried whether the machines would work. From Accra, Daniel Pels reports.
At Osu Cinema polling station, the queues are growing longer and tension is rising. Some of the people have been here since 3 o'clock in the morning, but voting is taking place only slowly. The polling station serves two constituencies. That's why there are two different queues, and many people have chosen the wrong one. When they finally reach the front, they are turned back by the polling officers and have to queue in the other line. That means waiting another couple of hours. Many here are desperate to cast their ballot and then go to sleep, and they blame polling officials for the disorder.
They are supposed to separate us from the other side so that the line will go smoothly, but they don't want to do it.
We didn't start early, we didn't start voting early, we started around 8:15. You see, the people there, 8:30, around 8:30 there.
The police, they don't know anything. They are just inside and protecting the ballot boxes. They should come here to the crowd and control the crowd.
Problems like this have been reported from a number of stations across the country. Local media report that some polling stations opened late because the voting materials had not arrived on time. In some places, people had a hard time voting because the biometric machines could not identify their fingerprints. But those that had predicated chaos were proven wrong. In the vast majority of polling stations, voting proceeded smoothly and the situation was peaceful. Ghana's vice president, Park Kwesi-Beko Amisa-Arthur, was one of a number of candidates who commended the voters on local television when he went to cast his vote.
There's a lot of enthusiasm. The report I'm getting suggests that the long queues have formed very early in the morning and people are patiently waiting to cast their votes, which is very encouraging for me. I think the country is behaving admirably. I hear that in a number of places election materials have not arrived, but people are still waiting. I encourage them to be patient, and everything will be all right.
Those that had cast their vote crowded around radios and TVs waiting for the results. The elections have been the topic of the day, and everywhere across the country people gathered to discuss their experiences at the polling stations. The final results of Friday's polls are expected on Sunday.
That was Daniel Pels reporting, and shortly before the program started, I spoke to him personally to ask him for more details of the day's voting.
Voting continued smoothly overall, but there were a few problems here and there, both in Accra and also at polling stations across the country. There were some reports of skirmishes, people in the crowd were getting furious because other people were trying to jump the queues, or people were furious because they had waited in the crowd for hours. So sometimes police had to be called in to control the crowd. Apparently also the army was deployed, but we have no reports that any kind of serious violence broke out. So these were just some tussles that could easily be solved by calling in the police. Also, we hear that in Accra, somebody was arrested for trying to enter a police station posing as a police officer, but in fact he was not. So polling officials called in the police who arrested him. So overall, it seems to be that the day went smoothly.
There were some complaints of delay and the biometric system that was used for the first time. What was it all about?
There was a biometric voter registration exercise earlier in the year, and people were fingerprinted. And now when they went to cast their ballot, they first had to go through a verification machine that checked the fingerprints. And we went to some polling stations here in Accra in the morning, and the polling officials there told us there were some problems, because when some of these people came, the machine actually couldn't identify their fingers. And then, according to the book, the people were not entitled to vote, but apparently in most cases, because they were having voter identification cards, it was possible for them to do vote eventually. But that sometimes, you know, created some delays at the station.
What statements did the main contenders make when they cast their ballots?
Well, both President John Mahama and also Nanu Akufo-Addo, the main opposition candidate, have praised the voters for their patience. They also expressed their delight that the polls were peaceful, that everything went on in a rather orderly manner. President Mahama said that he is very confident of winning, but that, of course, remains to be seen.
What is likely to determine the outcome of this election?
Well, both candidates, of course, have their traditional strongholds. So people in those strongholds are likely to vote for their respective candidate, no matter what. Then, on the other hand, of course, both candidates have tried to promise Ghanaians that their lives will improve. I mean, we mustn't forget that Ghana is an oil producer now and is also a fast-growing economy, but a lot of people haven't benefited from that at all. So both candidates have basically been promoting an agenda of development and social change, promising improvements to the education system. The opposition party, NPP, even promising free secondary education. They have promised to improve the health sector, to tackle the issue of youth unemployment. So basically it's all about those issues that matter most to people here in their daily life.
I was speaking to Daniel Peltz, who is currently in Ghana.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has said African oil-rich countries which allow Western countries to extract that black gold do not deserve to lead the continent. The Zimbabwean leader was speaking at his party conference Friday, from where DW correspondent in Zimbabwe, Columbus Mavunga, reports that Mugabe said he now wanted to take over all foreign-owned companies.
A rousing reception marked the arrival of President Robert Mugabe at his ZANU-PF party conference in Gweru, about 300 kilometers southwest of Harare. His close to two-hour speech could easily have passed for an elementary lecture on colonialism, imperialism, and then economics. His hatred for whites and Western companies investing in Africa, especially in his own country, was unmistakable.
We are very much awake. And the nonsense that capital is greater than any other factor is absolute nonsense.
Yes!
The gold, scoop the crow, scoop the diamond, scoop the copper, the owners of the resources. This is what they are doing to our poor, poor African countries.
Zimbabwe's government has embarked on what it calls an indigenization policy, which takes the majority stake of all foreign-owned companies. The 88-year-old Zimbabwean leader had a lecture for those African countries where especially Western investors are still allowed to own the entire equity of their companies.
That's theft.
Yes.
That's robbery. These are God-given resources. You are losing them. If you agree to that kind of thing, then you are not a good custodian of your people.
Yeah.
You don't deserve to be custodian. You don't deserve to be president of your people. Your government should never, never stand for your own people. If you agree that your resources belong to other people. That philosophy is dirty, is filthy, is criminal.
At the conference, Mugabe also said he wanted his ZANU-PF party to discuss how it can beat Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's MDC party in the next year's elections and replace the current coalition. He said he wanted elections soon and repeated his threat of holding polls without a new constitution. Earlier this week, ZANU-PF spokesperson Rugare Gumbo said all ZANU-PF people wanted Mugabe to be the party's presidential candidate in next year's elections. Pedzai Ruhanya, a media and democracy doctorate student at the University of Westminster, says the ZANU-PF conference is a mockery of the one South Africa's ruling ANC will hold later this month across the southern border of Zimbabwe.
If you look at the ANC since its formation in 1912, how many leaders have they had so far? Currently, as they go for Congress, we have Mohlande being nominated and Zuma being nominated. I think it is in the DNA of Mugabe that he should not be contested. Mugabe thinks that he is a monarch.
In the past, Mugabe has said he still has a lot to offer to Zimbabwe and cannot retire until he has achieved that. It remains to be seen how he plans to accomplish what he has not done in the past 32 years. But his supporters show no sign of running out of words of praise.
Columbus Mavunga with that report from Harare.
Human rights.
Now, in many African countries, church organizations show little understanding for calls for gay rights, a stance which also influences political decisions. Nigeria and Malawi are a case in point. Eric Segweda has been finding out why churches in Africa are opposed to same-sex relationships in this report adapted for us by Sarah Kamara.
Churches in Africa have recently been showing how they feel about homosexuality. In some countries, rallies are organized by church communities to protest against homosexuals. The Catholic community in the Nigerian city of Lagos, for example, has organized anti-gay protests together with other denominations. Father Raphael Adebayo says he does not know whether the church groups are going further to put pressure on politicians to tighten the law on homosexuality, but his own feelings are clear.
It is not possible that the church will back what God is against. It is very clear that homosexuality is an abomination.
The church is not alone with their reluctance to acknowledge the rights of homosexuals in Nigeria. Some politicians like Jagaba Adams Jagaba, member of parliament and chair of the Committee Against Drugs, Narcotics and Financial Crime, says homosexuality is a taboo in the Nigerian society.
We have a traditional religions who kick against it. Christianity kick against it. Islam kick against it. This is a taboo in our culture. That's why we as parliament, we pass that law to protect our culture and to protect our custom.
A yet-to-be-approved act in Nigeria states that people living in a homosexual relationship or who campaign for the rights of gays and lesbians may face prison sentences of up to 10 years. This dilemma has also faced the Malawian government. In November this year, several local media outlets quoted the country's justice minister as saying that laws banning homosexual activities will not be enforced any longer, pending a debate in parliament. This prompted a negative response from the Malawian Council of Churches, which is made up of several different denominations. Ian is a gay man from the Malawian town of Blanka.
What I know is about the Malawi Council of Churches, MCC. So it issued a statement saying that homosexuals are abnormal people, so they should not be allowed to be free.
Since the church's outcry, the government seems to have backtracked on its plan. Ian and others can only speculate whether this is a result of church pressure. The negative attitude of many churches towards homosexuality does not surprise Markus Gutfleisch, head of the German ecumenical working group Homosexuals and Church. Gutfleisch's working group finds it perfectly acceptable that churches should express their opinion about social topics, but their conservative views should not lead to human rights being violated, he warns.
The Catholic Church has often intervened, for example, in Europe and North America, whenever a government has presented a draft law that would give homosexuals greater rights.
According to Amnesty International, South Africa is so far the only African country where the rights of homosexuals are laid down in the constitution and same-sex marriages are allowed. In almost all other countries, the law foresees prison sentences for same-sex couples indulging in sexual relations. Like Nigeria, Uganda is also planning to introduce a law against homosexual acts, perpetrators of what is described as aggravated homosexuality, which includes homosexual acts committed by someone who is HIV positive, could receive the death penalty. Against this background, it is unlikely that the situation of homosexuals in Africa will improve in the foreseeable future.
Sarah Kamara with that report by Eric Segweda on gay rights, a stance that influences political decisions in some parts of Africa. The images which were flashed around the globe in 1993 still have the power to shock. They show armed Somalis dragging the corpses of US servicemen through the streets of Mogadishu. The Battle of Mogadishu, better known as Black Hawk Down, was a disaster for the Americans, the tragic conclusion of a UN military mission that began 20 years ago on the 9th December 1992. It was to have far-reaching consequences for US foreign policy towards Africa. This report by Frederike Muller has been adapted for Africa Link by Mark Caldwell.
Somalia was plunged into civil war after military dictator Siad Barre was ousted from power by armed groups in 1991. Food distribution was interrupted and a famine followed. On December 3, 1992, the UN Security Council decided that an international mission should be sent in to improve the security situation in the country so that humanitarian assistance could be provided. The command of the United Task Force, as it was called, fell to the United States. 20 years ago, Rashid Abdi was studying in Kenya. He remembers well the events in neighbouring Somalia and in the meantime has become an expert on the country. He says the mission was initially welcomed by the population.
Humanitarian corridors were secured, aid agencies began to move in and food was beginning to reach people who were desperate. But then eventually the intervention became political, it became military, and eventually I think when the American soldiers were killed, I think it really ended up in a disaster.
Those soldiers, 18 of them, were killed in October 1993 when Somali militia shot down two US helicopters. The corpses of the soldiers were dragged through the streets of the Somalian capital, Mogadishu. This has gone down in history as Black Hawk Down. The US pulled out its troops. Thomas Cargill works for the Chatham House think tank in the UK.
The experience of the US in Somalia during that period was very traumatic, and it really reduced the appetite for any kind of foreign intervention of that kind for a number of years, and it was an appetite that really didn't return until after 9/11. Instead, in Africa, there was a continued focus on humanitarian engagement.
That changed in 2007 when the US set up its new Africa Command, AFRICOM, based in Stuttgart, Germany. From that location, it controls US military activities in Africa, which are mostly training missions. Since 2011, US troops have been helping Ugandan forces in the hunt for the war crimes suspect Joseph Kony. And the Americans are also active in Somalia once again. They are supporting the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM. Donald Teitelbaum works for the Bureau of African Affairs at the US State Department.
Now, we have provided advisors to the African Union. We've provided technical assistance to the African Union mission and its component forces, and we are providing support to ministries now. But also, a lot of the specific shapes of that assistance will be defined by Somali communities themselves.
Since the autumn of this year, Somalia has a new president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, and, for the first time in 20 years of civil war, a functioning central government. The US is most interested in seeing stability brought to Somalia and the power of the Al-Shabaab Islamists curtailed still further. The AMISOM troops, with US support, have made significant gains in the struggle against Al-Shabaab. But is this indirect involvement by the United States advisable? Rashid Abdi once more.
I think the Americans are aware of the potential of their direct and very open military involvement in Somalia really being used by Al-Shabaab to whip up, anti-Americanism. So for that very reason, I think the Americans were cautious in not becoming directly engaged themselves, but supporting African countries who are, much more acceptable in Somalia.
Recently, the United States has been making extensive use of drones, unmanned surveillance aircraft, in the battle against extremists in Pakistan and Yemen. The deployment of drones is controversial, but a sign that military engagement has once again a high level of priority among U.S. policymakers.
Mark Caldwell with that report by Frederick Muller on the story of Black Hawk Down that happened 20 years ago in Somalia.
USA.
And in USA this week, we've had this letter from Henry in Kigali.
Regarding your recent article on the coalitions of scenarios in Kenya, your James Shumayula asserts that the coalition of Uhuruto is unbeatable because they have their regions block vote that could not be farther from the truth. I would like him to know in my arithmetic that the Rift Valley comprises many different communities that are against the deadly union of Uhuruto. This comprises the Luya, the Maasai, the Turkana, amongst others.
Well, I contacted James Shimanyula, our correspondent in Nairobi, and I asked him what he had to say in reply to this criticism.
It's interesting that people have been following political developments in Kenya with a keen interest, especially given that they got what I said through our Africa Link program, which appears to be becoming more popular in East and Central Africa, including Rwanda. Now, my answer is this. Henry was very right to have said that, but by the time he was speaking, things seemed to have taken a dramatic turn. It was a kind of high drama because things changed very fast. Given that Rift Valley has 10 million people, we expect about 4 or 5 million to register. This means that Ruto, Mudavadi Musalia, Uhuru Kenyatta, and other parties will have to share votes from there. And as you said rightly, it contains people from Luya, from Eastern, from Rift Valley, a mixture of all sorts of people. So he may be right, but I think I can put that arithmetically. Kikuyu form about 30% of the people living there. So they may play a major part in enabling Uhuru also do well there.
James Shimanyula, and if you have heard something, one of our programs you'd like to comment on, then please do as Henry did and send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de. Our postal address is Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany.
Listen to Africa Link where and when you want. Subscribe to our podcast and you will get the latest edition sent to you. Log on to mediacenter.dw.de/English/podcasts and look out for the Africa Link podcast. Africa Link, bringing you the story where and when you want it.
And before we end this program, a reminder of the top stories we've covered in the last 25 minutes. Voters in Ghana go to the polls to choose a new president and a new parliament. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe says African oil-rich countries, which allow Western countries to extract that black gold, do not deserve to leave the continent. We've also been hearing about the ill-fated UN mission to Somalia that was launched 20 years ago and ended disastrously for the United States. And there we come to the end of another week here on Africa Link. I've enjoyed being with you. Do tune next week when Mark Caldwell will be here. Until next time, this is Isaac Mugabe in Bonn.